My name's Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. How you doing? All right. I'm doing pretty good. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to come. It's always a privilege to participate. It's only the second time ever I've been in the state of Oregon. You know, a couple of days ago I went online to check out the weather, and I was somewhat disappointed because it's supposed to be like in the 50s and raining the entire time, and it's turned out to be spectacular. It's really beautiful. You know, you go to meetings, I always hear people say, you know, Dr. Bob said this, Bill said that. All this weekend I've heard Harlan said this, Harlan says that. But I'd really like to thank Harlan for asking me, and Don and Tim who picked us up at the airport yesterday and gave us the ride. I saw that beautiful spruce tree that's, what, 750 years old. I mean, it's really spectacular. So it's good to be here in God's country, you know. My sobriety date is June 2nd, 1988. My home group is the Underground Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays at 8 o'clock at 4th of Lombard in Philadelphia. If you have in the neighborhood, please stop by. We'd love to have you. Chapter 5 of the big book is real clear what I am supposed to do. I will tell you in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic, what happened to me, and what my life is like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born and raised in a very blue-collar ethnic neighborhood. I'm the fourth out of eight. Kitty talked about large Irish families. Her parents really didn't hold up their end of the bargain, five kids. That's not. So I'm one of an Irish octuplet. I have a sister who's 11 months older than me, and I am 11 months older than my next sister. There was no booze all in my house. My father did not drink, and my mother could not drink. Besides being pregnant for a little over 10 years. She also abused prescription medication, and my father was smart enough not to have any booze all in the house. My grandparents lived right around the corner from us, and my grandparents were great people, and they were immigrants, and my friends used to make fun of them because they used to talk kind of funny, you know? I don't know, I don't think they was much better, but you know. But their basement was finished as a bar, and that's where all the family functions were held, the graduations, the christenings, and things like that. And that's where I had my very first drink. Can you guys hear me in the back? No? Okay. Because I never had a problem getting a bar, or getting a drink in a crowded bar, you know, so I wanted to make sure you can hear me. So then, that's where I had my first drink. And I was just a kid. I didn't get drunk the first time I drank, but I remember what it was. It was Ballantine beer, and I remember that because Ballantine used to sponsor the Phillies. And I remember going up to Connie Mack Stadium with my father, and they had that old scoreboard in right center field, like the three rings. I forget what they were. It's almost like the four absolutes. But the three rings of Ballantine beer, like quality, purity, whatever the hell it was. But I remember what it was. I was running around polishing off the half empties, or the half fulls. I guess it depends on your perception. And I'm polishing off the half empties, and it was my uncles, and I come from, my mother's one of 11 and my father's one of 12, so I had lots of uncles, and it was my uncles pointed at me. He said, look at Bobby, look at, yeah, and that's what I craved. I craved the attention. I never felt a part of, and that's pretty tough to do when you got 10 people living in a small three-bedroom row home, but I never felt a part of, and that would be true even to an early recovery. My drinking really kind of took off in high school. Most of the kids in the neighborhood went to the local diocese in high school, but my parents had sent me to a private Jesuit high school. And right away, I felt kind of different, you know, because most of the kids who went to the school were from affluent families from the suburbs. It was just me and a couple other dirtballs in the neighborhood who went there. And we had a reputation because we used to walk to this school. Now, this school was like right in the city, and so a lot of these kids, it was their first introduction to the city. So their parents would drop them off in their luxury automobiles, and me and the guys from the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers. And I knew that was wrong. I knew that by the values instilled in me by my parents and by the nuns as a kid. But the need for me to be accepted by you outweighed anything else. So I compromised whatever values were instilled in me. And I had a lot of nicknames. Boom. Don't shoot me yet. Let me get to the point. I'll give you a reason later, but not yet. So then, wow, that throws you. But I used to shoot back. But it was, I knew that was wrong, you know, but one of my nicknames was Crazy Coil, and I would do things in my gut that was wrong, and I felt uncomfortable doing it. But the need for me to be accepted by you outweighed anything else, you know? I remember my freshman year at the prep. It was September, it was football season, there was an away game, there was drinking, there was fighting, we rented a bus, there was police activity. It was really a lot of fun. And I remember the first day back to school, we all had to go to the disciplinarian. And he had about 10 of us lined up outside his office. And they were all upperclassmen, all except me and another kid from the neighborhood. We're the only two freshmen. And he made a beeline. He came right up to us. He says, "What's with you guys? You guys here like 2 weeks and you're getting this jackpot already?" And I just shrugged my shoulders. I said, "You know, Father, just one of them things." And what it was, it didn't take me long to size up situations. I didn't play football, so I didn't hang out with those kids. Even though I did very well academically, I didn't hang out with the AP kids because they had a certain reputation. I was there about a week and a half. I found who the nitwits were, and that's who I wanted to hang out with. And that would set the tone for the rest of my life, you know. I knew, you know, it didn't take me long to find out. I was pretty good in checking the nitwits out. I guess we get this special glow about us. So, I mean... And my career there, you know, I didn't make the dean's list, but I didn't fail out either. I knew that I could just, I bare minimum effort required to get by. Like, mediocrity was my goal, and I was okay with that. I didn't want any attention. I didn't want the good attention, but I didn't want the bad attention either. Just given the bare minimum effort required to get by. And this school, it's in the middle of North Philadelphia. It's a pretty rough area. And the school's on the corner of 18th Street. And four blocks away was the subway. And at the end of the day, these kids, I guess because their parents were working, these kids used to wait for the trolley car to take the trolley four blocks to walk because they were scared to walk to the subway. Well, three blocks away, on the corner of 15th and Girard, there was a bar called the Ebony Showcase Lounge. When I was a junior, I was a regular at the Ebony. And I went there for a couple of different reasons. They had cold beer, they had dancers, you know, it was nice. But, you know, I would stroll out Girard Avenue to show these kids from the suburb how tough I was, me and a couple other guys from the neighborhood. And I'm not a tough guy, I never was, and I can now tell you every time I strolled out that street or I sat in a bar and I ordered a drink, I was terrified. But I didn't want anybody else to know, you know, playing the role, you know, and all that other nonsense that went with it. When it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education, and I knew that kind of ticked my parents off because they made a great deal of sacrifice to send me and my brothers and sisters to private school. They knew education was the key, and they got that from my grandparents. But I knew I couldn't stay home because they'd be held to catch. And you know, people like us, we don't like to catch no hell. We like to cause it, but we don't like to deal with the repercussions. So I knew I couldn't stay home because they'd be held to catch. And I was 17, I had no options. I mean, I had no money, I had no job skills, I didn't know what to do. So the only alternative that I thought was available to me was the service, and I enlisted in the service. That really wasn't a bright move back then because the military wasn't unpopular. I know there was guys living up north, but I enlisted. And after my training, I got sent overseas, and I spent 13 months overseas, and that's when my drinking really took off. I never messed around with other substances. I had a lot of good friends in my neighborhood who had gone over and got whacked on certain things. I mean, I never even smoked a joint, you know, so I had a fear of other substances. But I definitely had a drinking problem. I was there a couple months, and several good friends of mine got killed, and I didn't know how to handle that. Because in my family, we didn't talk about nothing. It was all surface stuff, you know? And once you moved out of the house, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the family. And if you lived in the house, everything stayed inside you and everything stayed within the walls of the house. And that's not a shot at my folks. I mean, that's just the way it was, you know? And I didn't know how to handle this with my friends getting killed. But booze numbed the pain, and that's what I did. I drank to numb the pain. And the same thing with my career in the military. I did not distinguish myself, but I didn't get in any jackpots either. The bare minimum effort required to get by. I didn't want to get noticed at all. I was just hoping it. God forbid I heard my name mentioned. I just didn't want any attention at all. When my tour was up, I came home, wound up taking a couple civil service exams, and then I enrolled in school. I went to St. Joe's. And the same thing in school. St. Joe, and it's a small school now, but it was even smaller when I was there. We probably had no more than 3,000 kids through all 4 years, you know, and there's about 20 guys in the class, and the same thing, I'm giving them bare minimum effort there. I'm not making the dean's list, but I'm not failing out either. Just doing enough to keep the attention off. And one day, it was the end of the spring semester, it's in May, and one of the guys had called me up and said, "Bobby, the Phillies are playing tomorrow. One of those businessman specials, you know, like one of them Tuesday, Wednesday afternoon games." And they said, "You want to go to the game?" I said, "Sure," because they wasn't going to miss me in the classroom. I really wasn't contributing there. So I went to the game, me and four other guys, and the Phillies had since moved. They're playing the Vet Stadium down in South Philadelphia. And I'm sitting at the top of the stadium, the 700 level, like you guys are, the upper deck. And I'm up at the upper deck, and I'm drinking that cheap watered-down beer, and the sun's beating down on me, and I'm getting trashed. And I said, you know what? I said, I'm going to run down the field and meet one of the players. And the guys I was with, they kind of shrugged me off and said, okay, Bob, because another nickname I had was Bullshit Bob. I used to tell people, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I did that. I didn't do nothing. I made stories up. I never get off the damn stool, you know? So, but I had worked my way. They used to have an old picnic area there, and I jumped over the fence, and I ran out in the field. And the San Diego Padres were in town, and Dave Winfield was the right fielder for the Padres. And I went out, and I shook his hand. I said, hi, Dave, how you doing? And he looked at me. He said, brother, what are you doing out here? And he's a big dude, you know? And I looked behind him. I saw the guards coming. I said, Dave, I got to go now. So I start running towards the infield. I want to slide into second base. But as I was running towards the infield, there was more guards coming from the third base side. I know I couldn't do that, because if I slid into second, I'd get caught. So I turned around. I start walking towards first base. And I'm walking like to give myself up, right? And I'm as close to the guards as Tim and I right now, and I'm going to give myself up. At the last second, I deked the guy, ran out in the outfield. And I'm running around, it seems like a screwball for about 10 minutes, but it's probably closer to like 2 or 3 minutes, right? And the stadium's going nuts. And up on the scoreboard, they put Mr. Excitement. Now, I had just gotten out of service, I'm in good shape, I'm juking and jiving, but the fact is, you know what, I'm drunk. It's hot, I'm about to get sick. The fence is 12 feet high, I got nowhere to go. So I stop in center field. I just wait for the guards to come get me. And I got this young, short, fat guy. I made him look stupid, you know? And they was taking me off the field. I got a standing ovation from 37,000 people. It was a pleasure. Now, I knew I was going to get a beating from these guards. That was okay. They could have beat on me all day long. You know, they was taking me up to the right field bullpen, and Tug McGraw was in the bullpen and gave me the thumbs up. Way to go. They could have beat on me all day long, because you know what? I knew I was going to be a legend in the neighborhood. I could drink for free for the next week off this story. You know? Now, this would be a type of story that I would make up. You know, Bullshit Bob, right? But I had them four other guys from the neighborhood. I knew by the time I get out of jail, they'd be already talking to the neighborhood. I'd be the talk of the town. I couldn't wait. You know, I'd like that kind of attention. But just as I was about to get my beating, a Philadelphia police lieutenant showed up. He said, what's the matter with you? He said, are you drunk? Are you high? I said, no, I'm just happy. Just happy to be here. He said, well, you better get your happy ass out of the stadium. So not only did he save me from getting beaten, but he saved me from getting arrested, because that was important, because about 6-7 weeks later, one of them civil service exams kind of panned out, and I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. They was hiring anybody back then. I'm not even old enough to drink. I'm about 2 months shy of my 21st birthday. When I grew up in Pennsylvania, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the drinking age has always been 21, and it's hard to drink in Pennsylvania. For instance, back then, you couldn't drink on Sunday because bars would be closed. You have to go to state stores. The state, to this day, the state runs the liquor thing, so you need to go to state store to buy booze. They close like at 6 o'clock. They're never open on Sundays. To buy beer, you go to the beer distributor, you can only buy a case, or you go to the bar and buy a six-pack. There's nothing like that. When I was in the Air Force and we went to different states where you can go to like a 7-Eleven or somewhere else where they had beer and wine, man, I was amazed. Man, this is great. So but Jersey was right across the river, and where I lived in Philadelphia, I could be over the bridge in Jersey quicker than I could be other parts of Philadelphia. And the drinking age in Jersey was 18, so we used to go over the bridge and drink all the time. But once I got sworn in, we had a mayor at the time, a guy by the name of Frank Rizzo. And Frank was a former cop and a police commissioner, and we loved him. And we were like a gang of 8,500. Where we did whatever the hell we wanted to do. And I remember when he swore us in, we're holding our credentials up. He said, gentlemen, in your hand, you're holding the ticket to the best show in town. And man, he was telling the truth. It was amazing. I spent my first 10 years in North Philadelphia, where I would see the ravages of alcoholism and drug addiction day in, day out. And at the end of the day, at the end of the tour, I would go out with guys in the squad, I would go to the bar to drink, to numb the pain. I saw a lot of things that bothered me, but I couldn't tell my coworkers that, because I didn't want to be thought less than. I wanted to be one of the boys. To the point that I engaged in behaviors in my gut that was new, that I knew was wrong. I knew that by the values instilled in me, by the nuns, by the Jesuits, by my folks. But I did it anyway, because the need for me to be accepted by these guys outweighed anything else. And it got ugly quickly. I back up for a bit. That story I talk about running on the field, I tell that story for a couple of different reasons. One, it's a true story. I get those four guys from the neighborhood who back me up. But you know, the truth is, you know what? It's the only funny story I got. I wasn't a funny guy. I wasn't a lover. I wasn't an athlete. I was none of that stuff. I was a lying, thieving, stinking, falling down, violent drunk. And if I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused everybody I came in contact with, you know? And thirdly, and more importantly, I was a blackout drinker from the very first start. You know, I'm talking even in high school. Now, I wasn't drinking every day in high school, but I was drinking on the weekends. But, you know, even then, I would go up to the corner. Like, if we was out Friday night drinking, I would come into the corner the next day, and my friends would tell me what I did before, and I had no memory of this. I was a blackout drinker from the very first start. When I eventually was in the VA hospital, I remember the doctor asked me, he said, "Do you ever have any blackouts?" I said, "No." I must have answered too quickly for him. He said, "Because, do you know what they are?" I said, "No." Once he described them, I said, "All the time." I thought that's how you had a good load. If you came to the next day and had no memory the night before, it was a good one, you know? So it was just nuts, and the handwriting was on the wall. You know, I had an uncle who was a boss on the job, and I was at a family function one time, and my uncle, he pulled me off to the side, you know. He said, "Bobby, I'm hearing stories about you. You're going to get yourself in a jackpot. You better take it easy." I was at work one time, and my immediate supervisor pulled me off to the side. He said, "You know what, kid? You're smart. You're going to go places, but that booze is going to mess you up, in one ear and out the other." Several years later, on two separate occasions, I ran into my uncle and that supervisor in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized at that point that they were trying to 12-step me. And I remember going up to my Uncle Jimmy, and I said, "You know," I said, "how come you didn't tell me?" You know, and he gave me one of them old-timer smiles. He said, "Bobby, you just weren't ready yet." Which just goes to show you that all the drinking and all the nonsense that went with it were necessary for me to hit my bottom. I made my first meeting in 1979. I don't tell people I went out because I really never came in, but I'll tell you what happened. I showed up at work one day, and one of my coworkers was drunk out of his mind. And on our job, we had an EAP, we had a counseling unit. And within that counseling unit, they had an EA group. And it was this little house that sat in the park. And I showed up at work one day, and the supervisor says, "You know, we'll take this guy, he's detailed to the unit for the day." I said, "Okay." So I come down this driveway, and this little house that sat in the park. And I'm coming down the road, and there's a guy sitting on the porch. His name was Eddie M. And Eddie and I had worked out of the same building. We had different duties, but he was downstairs. He was the turnkey in the basement. And I pulled up. I said, "Eddie," I said, "I'm dropping this guy off. He's detailed here for the day. I'll be back at 4 o'clock to pick him up." He looked me dead in the eye. I said, "Kid, do you want to come in?" I said, "No, I don't." I was insulted that he even asked me, because I knew what alcoholics were. Alcoholics were you older guys, you married guys, you guys with the three heads. I mean, I didn't have a problem. It was these poor souls I was dealing in day in, day out. They was alcoholic, not me. I mean, I'm a young guy. I'm pretty successful, you know. I'm a beer drinker. You can't be an alcoholic drinking beer. I mean, the only time I drank hard liquor was like on St. Patty's Day or New Year's Day or payday. But there was, you know... And when I got sober, when I got out of the VA hospital at my second AA meeting, Eddie was there. And again, he gave me one of them old-timer smiles. He said, "So, kid, you finally came around." Which just goes to show you that all the drinking and all the nonsense that went with it was necessary for me. I was 24 years old, and I shot and killed a 15-year-old kid in a line of work in a terrible situation that couldn't be avoided. Psychologists now have a phrase, suicide by police, but that term wasn't around 20-some years ago. And I used it as an excuse to crawl in a bottle, and that's what I did for the next 3 years. I wound up getting sober when I was 27. There was a lot of help offered to me, and I held people at bay, and I said I didn't want, you know, and they left me alone. I wound up getting promoted and transferred in my job, and one day I was at work, and I'm drinking, so this is where my drinking takes me, and I'm thinking I just need to do this, like, to protect my cover. So I'm in a position where I'm drinking, so my judgment was impaired, and I get in a position where I thought I needed to do other substances, and that's what I did. I got involved in other substances. My drug history is very short. It only lasted 17 months, and out of respect to the fifth tradition, that's all I need to talk about that stuff. It just went with the territory, just to let you know. You know, my life is falling apart, and I don't know what to do. you know. I didn't think anybody would help me because I was such a creep, you know. I had girlfriends at the time, and they said, you know what, Bobby, you're a nice guy, but when you drink, you just become an animal, you know. And I try to stop drinking, you know. I'm getting jammed up at work because I'm abusing my sick time, you know. I would try to stop, like, the, you know, the hold on to the girl. I would, Lent would come around, and I would try to go without it, and, I make 3 or 4 days, and I always fell off the wagon. You know, I tried to stop many, many times. I just could never stay stopped. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1988. We're sitting in this bar, guys from my squad, and we were in somewhat of a jackpot, so we were there to get our story straight. And it turned out to be drinking. I guess we got away from our primary purpose. We're drinking. We don't know what's going on. And one of the guys I was with decided that he needed to go home for some reason. God forbid he, like, take care of some sort of family obligation or something like that. And I decided I would give him a ride home because I did not think that I was as drunk as he. The term designated driver is just coming out at this time. So I said, I'll give him a ride home. Now, I'm a show-off. I always was a show-off, and so I'm going to show off my driving skills with my coworker here. And that's pretty easy to do, especially since it's not my car. It's these, you know, these city cars, unmarked cars. And I would see things on TVs and in the movies that I would always try to duplicate. And you know what? I was never successful. And I told some stories. You know, I swear to God, one time I actually wrapped a car around a goalpost. Football field. I mean, you're talking 100 yards, right? But there's another 100. There was nothing within 200 yards. I wrapped the car around it. I wrapped the car around it so much, I swear to God, it looked like the goalpost was actually growing out of the car. And I remember I got out of the car and I ran around, like, up and down, did a couple wind sprints, and I got on my radio to sound like I was out of breath. And I said, like, I was chasing somebody. I just crashed my car. I mean, that's the type of stories. I told stories all the time. And they knew, but you know what? They never had the proof. And you never tell the truth, you know? So I'm going to show off my driving skills. And I'm coming out this street, one-way street, and there was a kid riding towards me on a bicycle. And there was a big stone wall on my left-hand side, and I decided I was going to play chicken with this kid because it would be funny to see him jump off the bike and grab the wall. So I don't tell my coworker that. We get closer, unfortunately, at the same direction I ran this kid over. As he lied bleeding on the hood of my car, I got out of my car on my nightstick and was going to beat this kid because I thought he was going to milk me in the city for an insurance claim. The guy that I was with prevented me from doing that. I pulled the kid off the hood of my car, threw him onto the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled his crumpled bicycle from underneath my car and threw that off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar, made some sort of smart-aleck remark, and I continued on drinking. When I came to the next day, I realized I was in serious, serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody helped me because I was such a creep. A few weeks before, I'm home from work, and I'm reading the Daily News, and there's an article there, and at the end of the article, there's a little box, and there's some questions, and it says, alcohol problems, drug problems, depression, thoughts of suicide, marital problems, and it was a phone number. And I look at it, and I'm 4 out of 5, and I'm sure, because I was single, and I'm sure if I was married, I would have been batting 1,000, and they talk about the moment of clarity, but as soon as it came, it quickly left. But I stuck it in, I cut it out, and I stuck it in my wallet, and I continued on drinking. I checked in the hotel the next day after I ran that kid over, and I got a bottle of liquor, a case of beer, and some other substances with the intentions to consume all this stuff to build up the courage in my life. And 3 days later, with all the stuff gone, they're knocking on the door to kick me out. And I couldn't shoot myself because at this point I was suspended from my job. I no longer had access to my weapon. So, but I was in a lot of pain. I needed to end it. So what I did, I walked over to the window. I opened up the window, and I was going to jump out the window. I opened up the window. I was on the 5th floor. I remembered I was scared of heights. I made 23 jumps. I never overcame my fear of heights. So I went in the bathroom, and I filled the bathtub up with water and had a blow dryer, and I was going to put a blow dryer into the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. But every time I put a blow dryer into the tub, it would come unplugged. I was about 1.5 feet short on cord, and I got 1 foot in the tub, and I'm leaning trying to plug it in. And it's okay to laugh, and it's like that scene out of Woody Allen movie where he couldn't even kill himself, you know? But I never want to forget the pain I was in that day. So the only other tool that I had left was my car. So I got my car, took one last spin through the neighborhood. I guess I wanted to get a last look at everything. And I come driving down the East River Drive, which is a very winding road along the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia. And this was like a Wednesday or Thursday morning around 10 o'clock, 10:30, and this would be important because if this was any other time of day, I would have probably succeeded in my intent, which was to go into oncoming traffic to end my life. And I handled enough jobs like this, and I knew that oncoming traffic, head-on collisions definitely would do the trick. And the speed limit is like 20, and I'm doing about 45, 50, and I'm cooked, and I'm hungover, and I'm crying. And as I'm coming down the drive, I had remembered something. And I saw a lot of things on the job that bothered me, but there was one thing. When I was young, I was a couple years on the job, I'm like 22, 23 years old, I had to knock on this guy's door. I had to do a notification. I had to tell him that his kid was killed in an automobile accident. And he was a young guy. He was probably in his late 30s, early 40s. And it wasn't the worst thing I ever done, far from it. But you know what? I actually saw like the life leave this guy. You know, and it's the only way I could describe it. And I was always haunted by that. And I don't know why. And I would see him a few weeks later. And, you know, we were going through the court process. And like he aged. Like he was like in his, it looked like he was in his 50s or 60s. He was never the same. His family never recovered. And my intent was going to oncoming traffic, and I thought about this guy, this guy's family. And I now know that it was my higher power, but I didn't know that then. And because as much pain that I was in, and I need to end my pain, I certainly did not want to inflict that type of damage on anybody else, you know, and thank God for that. But I still need to end my pain. So I decided I would wrap myself around a tree, and we had these like big old oak trees along the drive, you know, and I handle jobs like that. You usually hit them. They don't budge. They don't even move. And I knew that would be successful. And then I just lost it, man. I just started crying. And like I said, I'm flying, I'm coming down, and I now know my higher power is looking out after me, and I didn't realize that then. And I finally pulled over at the end of East River Drive as Boathouse Row. And I pulled behind the, I just pulled over, and I sat behind the wheel of my car, and I cried like a baby for about 10 minutes. And I reached in my glove box, where you always carry the extra, and I didn't have extra guns at the time, but my wallet was in there, and I pulled out the wallet, and inside my wallet was that article that I had clipped out at Daily News about 6 weeks before. And it's no longer there, but at the end of the drive was one of those old glass enclosed phone booths. And I walked over, and I dialed the phone number up, and the woman who answered the phone, I spoke to this woman like I spoke to no one in my life before. I told her the truth. I told her everything that was going on in my life. And God bless her, she listened patiently. And she said, listen, why don't you drive over to Hahnemann Hospital and somebody be waiting to talk to you. And that's like about a 5-minute ride. So I drove over and they were waiting for me. They admitted me to their 11th floor, their psychiatric unit. And they kept me there for about 3 days just to get me kind of stabilized. And from there I got transferred to the VA hospital out in West Philadelphia. And I spent about 4 to 5 weeks on their flight deck. And from there I got transferred to the VA hospital out in Coatesville. And I spent a couple weeks in their flight deck before I got put in an alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over that day and made that phone call, Alcoholics Anonymous was the furthest thing from my mind. I didn't think that I was an alcoholic. I was a beer drinker. There's no way you could be an alcoholic drinking beer. I thought my real problem was the short use of other substances. If I left that crap alone, I'd be okay. Maybe I got this mental illness and I inherit this from my mother. Maybe I got this stress stuff they're now talking about. I got this from the experience in the job, or I got this experience in the military. Maybe it's the fact that it's the neighborhood I live in. Maybe it's the fact I'm a mummer. But it can't be alcohol because I'm a beer drinker, and there's no way you could be an alcoholic drinking beer, you know? When I got put into the alcohol and drug ward, at this point I probably have about maybe 8-9 weeks under my belt. And I get put, so I got to get the lay of the land, you know, the arrogance creeps in, I got to check it out. And I wander into the day room. And in the day room, up on the wall, they had the large window shades of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And I zip through the steps, I got about 6 of them done, you know. I see the amends, I said, they're screwed, that doesn't apply to me. But what later happened that night, 2 men would come up. I would later find out that they were part of the treatment facility committee. I did not know that then. They came up to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The moment the speaker said something about his background that I could not identify with, did not relate to, or just plain didn't like, I would immediately tune him out. I was too busy listening to the messenger and not the message. And I start looking around my peers, you know, and a lot of these guys, they had difficulties. They had kids who hated them. They had stay away orders from their wives and stuff like that. And I said, I didn't have that problem. Probably due to the fact that I'd never been married and didn't have any kids. May had something to do with that. A lot of these guys had legal problems. I didn't have any legal problems. Probably due to the fact that I had a gold shield in my back pocket. I was looking for the differences and not the similarities. What bothered me the most, without any question, was at the end of the meeting, everyone got in a circle and said the Lord's Prayer. If this is what you people are about, then I don't want nothing to do with you. Because I hated God, you know. And I know they're strong words, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but that's the fact it was. And to be honest, that doesn't even sum up the feelings. I hated God for a couple different reasons, and they were all legitimate. But the most important reason I hated God, you know, I talk about my mom. My mom was like a fundamentalist in the church, you know. And she was in a charismatic movement, and she believed she could speak in tongues. And there was pictures and candles and all that stuff throughout the house. I was 15 years old. I came home from school one day. I found my mother, and my mother had slit her wrist. And she looked up at me and she said, Bobby, help me. And I looked down and I said, good for you. And I walked out of the house. And I got an older guy to go to the state store and got a bottle of wine. I drank the wine. And I came home later that night. My father told me what happened. I acted surprised. I said, oh, yeah, how about that? That happened when I was 15. I got sober when I was 27. That was 12 years of hating God. And it would be a couple more years before I would even address this issue. So I would not say hands and I didn't say the prayer. A nurse came up to me, a psychiatric nurse. And I'm about to say this, and please, it's not to get a joke. She had to be a member of Al-Anon. She was just a beautiful lady, and she saw all through my crap. And she said, you know what? The only way you're going to make it, you're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to tell you that's the best piece of advice I got. The VA hospital helped me tremendously. They certainly did. I had a lot of crap. They were a tremendous help. But I would get my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to AA every single day. Sometimes two or three times a day, depending what tour I was working, you know. And I don't drink coffee, never have in my life, so I don't make it. That's the way it is. I don't smoke cigarettes, I've never had in my life to this day, I've never smoked a cigarette, so I don't empty any ashtrays. I walk into a big book meeting or a step meeting that was strictly by accident, I would leave at the break, I had something more important to do. Tradition meetings. Rules. Let me tell you, we love to enforce them. We don't like to follow them. They're for other people. I ain't interested in traditions, either. The moment that the speaker said something about his background that I could not relate to, did not identify with, or didn't like, I immediately tuned him out. Too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. But I made meetings, and I was crazy as a bedbug. I just got nuts. I wouldn't say the prayer. I made meetings. I'm sitting in this bar. I'm sober 8 months. Because they sell real good roast beef. Good. Your socks will roll up and down. This is good stuff, right? And I'm in there, and I'm drinking seltzer out of a rock glass, you know? And the truth is, I mean, that's what I'd say, you know, like, that's why I was there. But the truth is, the reason I was there, because I was arrogant. Because, you know what, I was very successful in the early part of my career. There was a lot of attention, and like, just in case you happen to miss the article, I would have an extra two or three that you certainly could take home and put in your scrapbook. So, but towards the end of my drinking, there was a lot of negative publicity. And the reason I was in the bar was the arrogance, was to tell people, you know what, it ain't that bad. Don't believe what you read. I'm back, things are cool. I don't know who that guy was, certainly wasn't me. That's why I was there. But a couple guys came in, they was from the neighborhood, and they thought it was necessary to knock me down a couple pegs, and I certainly could understand that. And they were just like, you know, breaking, you know, they were giving me a hard way to go, giving me, you know, just busting chops, right? And one guy just got a little too close, and I just had enough, and I stood up and I punched him in the face with that rock glass. And I opened him up, he bled like a pig. And I knew the uniformed guys, one of the two came in, I knew one of the guys, and he came up to me and said, man, what's with you? You're nuts? And I told him what was going on. He said, get the hell out of here. And I had learned my lessons about people, places, and things. And I have since found a place that sells real good roast beef without being that type of environment. You know, in fact, I took Bob. We had roast pork. I mean, it's a great spot. No booze and no fights. And if you ever come to Philly, I'd love to take you and get a sandwich, you know. But that's how nuts I was. I was sober a year. My home group at that time, you told your story. And when I got done speaking, it was amazing. It was thunderous applause. The blind could see. The lame walked. It was really, truly an experience. And people came up and they patted me on the back and say, way to go, Bobby. You're doing so good. I lied during my entire story. The fact that I identified myself as an alcoholic because of my home group, you couldn't talk about that other stuff. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I thought my problem was other substances. If I left that crap alone, I'd be okay. Maybe I had this stress stuff, you know, from the job, from the service. Maybe I had this mental illness from my mom, you know, it's the neighborhood I lived in. I'm a mummer. I mean, in fact, during the course of my story, a bottle of beer appeared in my head. But you guys want to hear that. You want to hear all the quotes, and I was pretty sharp, you know. I knew how to hold information and give it back to you. And you came up and you patted me in the back and said, Bobby, you're doing so good. And I was lying. I was dying inside, lying to you and dying inside, you know. I was sober 23 months. I beat another man with a baseball bat. I forget what step I was working that day. But I was nuts. I swear to God. I was crazy. I hated everybody. But you know what? After the end of the meeting, the old guys would come up to me and say, Bobby, we're going to the diner. You want to go? I would say, no. But God, I hung around, so I got that invitation. And if they didn't invite me, I'd get mad. I couldn't believe it. But I hung around, and they'd always ask me. And I said, no, I don't want to go. What are you, nuts? And my very first outside meeting when I got out of the VA hospital, my very outside meeting, first meeting, was a man and woman speaking, husband and wife. They were celebrating 10 years of sobriety. The woman had one more day than her husband. And she constantly reminded him of that, you know. And I found that hard to believe. I said, 10 years, come on, you know. I didn't believe that. I thought maybe you go over to the bridge and drink in Jersey, keep your Pennsylvania time. I thought, I mean, I swear to God. You know, I thought I was nuts. But there was a guy from my neighborhood. His nickname was Troubles. And in fact, when I first saw him, I was shocked because I thought he was out of debt or in jail. And that was a hard-earned nickname. And he was in and out of jail like in the 60s and 70s. And he's sober like 3 or 4 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't believe anybody else with their time. But this guy, I personally knew. See, my neighborhood at that time, almost 20 years ago, it's going through a gentrification process. You know, the yuppies are coming in. And so, and AA is just a microcosm of society. What happens out there happens in here just on a smaller scale. So there were a lot of yuppies in the neighborhood. And so there were a couple yuppies in the meeting. And I didn't know them. But this guy was a neighborhood guy. And I knew what he was about. But he had this glow about him. He was for real. I need to tell you, that is the only reason I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I saw him and said, you know, I mean, even though I knew that I should go, but I saw him, I knew, I said, man, hell, if he stays sober, anything's possible. But I was just nuts. I swear to God, in early recovery, my first couple years, I used to go to a lot of gentlemen's clubs, right? And I would get my picture taken with the entertainer, and I would come to the meetings and pass the pictures around to the old timer because I figured they would like that. They would look at the picture and they would shake their head and look again, they shake their head. I said, please, kid, please keep coming back. And I thought they were being facetious. So I said, all right, I'll keep coming back. I mean, I swear to God, I had no idea who John Barleycorn was. I was wondering why everybody's blowing this guy's anonymity. I said, he must be a really tough SOB. I wouldn't want to tangle with him. When I found out who John Barleycorn was, I felt so stupid. But here I was so damn bright, it damn near killed me. In my home group, we had a corkboard anniversary, first name, last initial, date of month, how many years you're celebrating. True story, you know. If Joey A got 3 years and Bobby C got 2 years and Joey A went out, I said, good for him, he's out. This is about time, you know, I don't care. I said, he's out, I'm in, you know. I mean, that's how nuts I was. No one asked me to be their sponsor. No one wanted what the hell I had. I didn't carry the message, I carried the disease. And the only time I get my hand up to share something was to take a shot at somebody. I mean, serene people scared the hell out of me. You know the old saying, you can't miss what you never had? Well, I never had peace of mind, so I never miss a damn thing. So I would go to meetings, and they were nice and serene. I would get my hand up to add my insanity to set it off. I mean, I was nuts. And the worst meetings were Sunday after retreat. I swear to you, I would go to meetings. Like, I'd be working, day working. I'd be in meetings on Friday and Saturday night. I said, where the hell's everyone at? And then Sunday, they come floating in. I said, oh, Christ. At one of them retreats, and they come in and they glowing, and I said, oh man, they were the worst. They were the worst, you know. I hated everybody, but you know who I hated the most? I hated the newcomers. Because the old timers, I thought you were lying about your time anyway, but I hated the new guys. How dare they get better before me? You know, because I've been sober, you know, coming up in a couple years, and I see these guys, and I see these people come in. I see, you know, they're nuts. And they get better before my eyes, and I'm jealous. You know, the reason they got better before me, because they were willing to do some work that I wasn't willing to do before me. But I hated them the most, you know. But I also learned from that, because as much as I had a resentment towards God, I knew God was at work, because I saw these guys get better before my eyes. I'm in a meeting one time, and they came up, and they kind of tricked me. And the way you trick a newcomer is, I guess you don't give them a chance to formulate the lie. And they came up to me and said, Bobby, are you working this weekend? And before I knew it, I said, no. I said, oh, too late. Wish I would have pulled it back. They said, good. They said, we're going on a retreat this weekend, and we're going to take you on a retreat with us. And I don't want to go. And I tell you, the real reason I wanted to go, I was around long enough that I knew that you couldn't get kicked out of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was also around long enough and knew that not everyone was always greeted warmly in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I'm in the car, going until Friday afternoon, I'm sitting in the back seat. I got a big guy on each side of me. It's like role reversal, because at work I drive and you're in the back seat. But here I am, I got a big guy on each side of me in the back seat. And the closer we get to the retreat house, the bigger the knot gets in my stomach. Because I can't tell these guys about what happened to my mom, you know. I knew that they wouldn't kick me out, but I knew I just knew that I would be ostracized. I mean, but I wasn't saying the prayer. They knew I had a problem, but I didn't think, you know, this was like one of them things like you just could overcome. So, but the need for me to be accepted by these guys, I know I made fun of them, but the truth is they were good men. They were willing to go to any length to help me despite myself. And I really did everything in my power to keep them at bay, to sabotage my recovery, but you know what, they would have none of it, you know. So the closer we get to the retreat house, the bigger the knot gets in my stomach. And it's like a Friday afternoon, 4:30, 5 o'clock, we get there and say, Bobby, we want to introduce you to the retreat master. I said, all right, come on, let's get this over with. Walk down this long hallway, they knock on this door. Oh, the guy says, come in. I come in. He stands up, he smiles. He's my disciplinarian from high school. He comes up and he hugs me, but not only that, but I also find out that he's a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he starts talking to me, wants to know, he says, how you doing? I said, I'm good, Father, how you doing? And he wants to know where I'm going to meetings, wants to know how long I'm sober, and I'm giving him the, you know, giving him a 411, letting him know what's going on. He says, who's your sponsor? I said, I don't have one. Because I'm a pretty bright guy. He knew that. He knew I was a bright guy. He said, I strongly suggest you get a sponsor. So I asked my roommate to be my sponsor. God forbid, should I ever be questioned again? I go to a meeting and say, Bobby, who's your sponsor? There he goes, right there. And I never called this guy. The only time I talked to him is when I accidentally bumped to him in the meetings. He would say, Bobby, I still got that same phone number. I said, yeah, I'll give you a call. I never called him. What I used to do, I used to tell people, you won't believe this guy. He wants me to do this. He wants me to do this. He said that. He didn't do nothing. I made it up. He put the hand of AA out there. Not only did I slap it away, but then I characterized the guy to boot. I mean, that's how nuts I was. You know, it was crazy. You know, I volunteered to set up my first commitment to set up chairs for a beginner's meeting. Me and my friend, Wacky Jackie. That's all you need to know about him. You know, the name sums it up. So we sit the chair, and it was a beginner's meeting, and it's a meeting like this, certainly not this large, but all the chairs facing this way, and this is the head table. So we get there early, and we set all the chairs up, and we have them facing that way. Because you know how we, and we did it on purpose, because we want to get some sort of reaction. But no one said nothing to us, which really threw us for a loop. So next week, we came, and we got there early, and we set the chairs up that way. And people was looking around, and I could tell they was disturbed, but still no one would say nothing. And I wanted the reaction, and I did this all my life. I wanted reactions. I did stuff on purpose. The third week, we got them. We set all the chairs going up that way. That was it. At the end of the meeting, a couple of the old-timers and some of the bigger men in the group came around and surrounded Jackie and I and said, listen, knock that crap off. You want to set the chairs up next week, you can. They fix that way, and you know. And here I was trying to do everything to sabotage my recovery, and these men would have none of it. You know, I joke about them, but you know what? They were good, good men, you know. In spite of myself, they were willing to help me. My second anniversary came, I didn't celebrate it. A month after my second anniversary, I went to eat my gun. The same pathetic feeling I had 25 months before, but 25 months before I'm loaded with drugs and alcohol. Here I am, stone cold sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to eat my gun. Safe to assume my life was unmanageable. I'm at a meeting on a Friday night, and I see troubles there. And at the end of the meeting, I go up to him. I said, Bobby, I said, I need some help. I said, would you help me? And he looked at me, and he said, Bobby, I've been watching you these past couple years. And I figured, good, he likes me because he's a good guy, right? And he says, you're full of shit. That's not the response I'm looking for. He says, I'm going to be your sponsor under certain conditions. Hey, you're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to a big book meeting a week. You're going to go to a step meeting. You're going to go to a men's meeting. You're going to get yourself a coffee commitment, and you're going to leave them damn women alone. And I'm saying to myself, who's he talking to? I'm sober 25 months. I'm selling the grapevines. I got it going on here. But what I did do, I looked him dead in the eye. I says, okay, I'm willing to do that. And we went back to his house, and I took the first three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. There was no question about it. But like I said, I went to eat my gun. My life had to be unmanageable. And if that was the problem, the solution was really simple. It had to be a power greater myself. And as much as I hated God, and I did that, this point, I still hated God, and I still wouldn't say the prayer. But I knew that there was a power greater myself because I saw these newer people getting better before my eyes, and that was the evidence. So when we got done talking about the first two steps, we got on our knees together and we said the third step prayer. And when we got done, he stood up. He said, Bobby, the way we do a third step, we pick paper and pen up and do a fourth step. I said, whoa, easy does it. Let's keep it simple. I didn't want to do one of these. I'm going to meetings and people say, oh, I'm doing a fourth step, stirring some, I feel like going out and all this other stuff. You know what? I want to eat my gun. You can't get no further out than that. So I did my fourth step, and you know what? It wasn't the great big boogeyman I thought it was. It took me a while because, you know, I'm a lazy guy. You know, when my back was up against the wall, I was really willing to do some work. And then there were other times I wanted to stay sober on yesterday's sobriety. So it took me a while to finish that fourth step. But when I get done, I call my sponsor up. And I said, Bobby, I'm going on a retreat this week, and I'm going to do that fifth step with a priest. He said, Bobby, that's great. When you get done, stop by my house so you can do it with me. And you know how sponsors are sometimes, and I guess they pick that stuff up. They get them telepathic powers. And before I could say something flip, he said, Bobby, I'm your sponsor, and this is a journey. If I'm supposed to help you out with these character defects coming up, I think I should need to know what they are, even though I have a pretty good idea. And he hung up. The reason I want to do the fifth step with the priest, it was not to be spiritually enlightened. I have God on the list, religion on the list, you know, my mom, and it wasn't to be spiritually enlightened. I still had them strong feelings. And the truth was, there was a lot of other things about my behavior that I was embarrassed about. And I couldn't tell my sponsor for the fear that he would pass judgment on me, he would ridicule me, or even worse, he would break the confidence and tell somebody else, which was probably a clue that my fear list wasn't completed. So I never did that fifth step with a priest. I did that fifth step with my sponsor. And you know, he did none of those things. They turned out to be unfounded fears. He didn't pass judgment on me. He didn't ridicule me. And to the best of my knowledge, he never told anybody else. And in fact, what he did, he shared some of his stuff with me, which took away the terminal uniqueness in which I thought I had. Now, he had gone to jail in the 60s because he had taken a man's life in a bar fight. And that's not why he asked him to be my sponsor. But he just helped me tremendously. He was just a very good man. And as I'm about to leave, he said, whoa, hold on. He lived by himself. He had a little house, and one of his rooms, his spare bedroom, he had set up as a quiet room. He said, you need to sit in there for that 1 hour. I said, oh, you know, I couldn't sit for 5 minutes. You know, I was always kind of a rambunctious type of guy. And I sat there for the hour, and I didn't drift off, and it must have been longer than the hour because he knocked on the door. And you know what? I can only talk about my experience. And you know what? It was like the screaming inside stopped. I'm sober about 33, 34 months at this point, you know, and it was just amazing, you know. We didn't burn my fourth step at the end of that fifth step. He told me I would need this for the rest of the steps. 6 and 7, character defects. I didn't know what the hell these were. I knew when I drank, I was a character. I found out when I did my inventory that I had no character whatsoever. You know, I thought I was the greatest cop in the city, you know, and that's the truth. Well, that wasn't truth. I engaged in behaviors that put other people at risk. I thought I was the greatest uncle, you know, all my nephews and nieces. And, you know, because I would buy stuff, and that wasn't true because I missed family functions and I wasn't reliable and I wasn't dependable. And I turned out that I was a rotten brother, a rotten son, and the sixth step, I became willing. And the seventh step was a prayer. And my sponsor said, Bobby, you need to put legs on those prayers, you know. I used to be one of them guys, oh, yeah, I turned it over, you know, and then the truth, I didn't turn nothing over. When I say that, that's like code, like I'm not doing nothing, you know. But the seventh step, you know, God will do for me what I can't do for myself, but this is a program of action, and I need to bring the shovel. And I got a laundry list of character defects, and one of them is sometimes I may not be the most patient guy in the world. And I could pray all day long, God, help me be patient, help me be patient. But during the course of the day, should you cross my path and you try my patience, and I lash out with sarcasm, and sarcasm is nothing but anger, it's also referred to as language of the Irish, if I lash out in sarcasm, that prayer for patience goes right out the window, you know, and I need to do the work. Because I did not burn my fourth step, when I did my fifth step, half my eighth step was done. I used to go to these meetings, eighth and ninth step meetings, I said I never harmed anybody but myself. That should have been a tip-off. I never did my inventory, because once I did my inventory, I found out that I harmed everybody I came in contact with. And unfortunately, those closest to me the most were harmed the most, you know. And I had to throw more names down in there. And if I didn't have, you know, the willingness, I would pray for the willingness. I already had experience in a couple steps with this. The ninth step, direct amends. No phone calls, no letters from me, because I didn't beat you with a bat over the phone or through the mail. And I'm kind of clever when I want to take those measures. You know, the truth is, if I'm really honest, I'm probably fear is consuming me. I'm afraid to face you. And I'd like to share two experiences on the ninth step. I'm at a meeting. This is about 15, 16 years ago. This guy walks down the steps. I have not seen this guy since 1977. He is not on my eighth step, not for any fear. I just plain forgot. They say more will be revealed. As soon as it came down the steps, it was revealed. What I used to drink with this guy, he was a big guy. I always liked to fight big guys. I don't know why I wasn't good at it, but I did it anyway. I always drank bottled beer. I didn't like draft beer. I drank bottled beer. And I was in a bar one day, and this big guy was getting thrown out of the bar, and he was giving the doorman a hard time, and I thought I was obligated to help the doorman since I lived there. And I went up, and I smacked this guy on the side of the bottle with smacked him on the side of the head with the bottle. And glass flew, and beer flew, and this guy, he didn't even flinch. I weighed as much as one of his legs. He turned around and said, "Why'd you hit me?" I knew I was in trouble. He took me outside. He's sitting on my chest. He's punching me in my face. My head's bouncing off the cement. I look him dead in the eye. I said, "You're in trouble now." I think I broke his hand with my nose. I mean, I was just nuts. But this guy, his name, he came down the steps, and I recognized him right away, but he didn't recognize me. You know, we sober up, we clean up. So I stand up. I get introduced. I stand up. I look him dead in the eye. I said, "My name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic." Now, I need to tell you a quick moment here why I use my full name. I know these traditions are top secret, so don't worry about it. I won't get into them with you. But, you know, they're kind of misunderstood, and no more so than this 11th tradition. All of a sudden, we get sober. It's like we join the mafia, you know. And we get these nicknames. And, you know, we got Jimmy the Coat and John the Brick and Bucktooth Mary and Red Sweater Jerry and Frank the Fox and Pepsi George. You know, all of a sudden, I don't want no one to know that I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody in my neighborhood knows I was a stark raving lunatic drunk. There's those little telltale signs. They come outside to catch me, I'd be urinating on their car. My girlfriend throw the clothes out the window. I'm slumped behind the wheel of the car. All of a sudden, I get sober. Whoa. You know, it's wild. The 11th tradition is real clear. Personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. That means... That means you will never see my face. I like back in the old days with them Lone Rangers masks. They're pretty cool. I like them. Kind of kinky, but they're cool. But, you know, that means you will never see my full face clearly identified with my name underneath, which is Robert Ignatius Benedict Coyle III, followed by the statement, "Is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." You won't find that on television. You won't hear that on the radio. You won't see that on the newspaper. That would be a violation of the 11th tradition. I mean, God forbid, 3 o'clock in the morning, you feel like drinking, you call information. "Yeah, I'd like to have Frank the Fox's phone number." You know? Or you want to go visit one of these beloved old-timers in the hospital. "Yeah, I'm here to see Jimmy the Coat." You know, I mean, it's not going to happen, you know? Dr. Bob in The Good Old Timers, which is a great book, you know, Dr. Bob said, "Where one drunk is anonymous from another drunk, that is a violation of the 11th tradition." You know, he went on to say that anonymity is spiritually inspired and secrecy is feared inspired, and this is not a secret society. However, I have no right to break your anonymity. You know, I was involved in service back in Area 59 where we use our full name, but I have no right to break anybody else's anonymity. So I'm off that soapbox, I'm back to the meeting, and I see this guy. Now, I tell you what I used to do to this guy. I was drinking with this guy, and one day we had words, and he kind of backed down. So from that point on, whenever I wanted to impress anybody how tough I was, I would pick on this guy. Verbal taunts, you know. One day I slapped him. And then one day I even spat upon him. I mean, what worse than the utter degradation of spitting on another human being? And he would do nothing. So I recognized him right away, and I looked him dead in the eyes, and "My name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic." And then he nodded. He recognized me. And when I got done speaking, I looked him dead in the eye because, and I heard it this morning from one of the speakers, you know, for me, making amends is much more than saying I'm sorry. Because for me, there's two words that don't mean squat. It's about righting the wrong, you know. And I looked him dead in the eye. And the financial amends are real easy. I go in my pocket, I pay you, I go on a payment plan with you. But what about the psychological damage or the emotional damage? How do I make amends for that? You know, and I was told that I sit down and have conversations with people. I don't exhibit that behavior again, and I pick up whatever responsibility I abdicated before. Like, I sat down with my dad, and then, I told him everything went on, but then I became a son again, you know, and you do the deal. It's like a living amends. So I looked this guy dead in the eye because I figured I'd publicly humiliate him. The best I can do is make amends to him publicly. It certainly wasn't the grandstand. And said, "Bob, I'm truly sorry, and as long as I stay sober, I hope I don't treat you or any other human being the way I treated you." You know what? He came up and he hugged me. It was a credible experience. So at the end of the meeting, we start talking. I said, "Bob, I haven't seen you in years. How you doing?" He said, "Bobby, I'm sober 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Get out of here. You know, I'm sober for a while. I'm doing a deal. Everyone in AA in Philadelphia knows me. They may not like me, but they know me. You know, I'm involved in the service. And I said, but I haven't seen you. Now, this meeting we're at, I live in South Philadelphia. He lives in Roxborough, which is like Northwest Philadelphia. This meeting is at North Philadelphia, 11th of Rockland. And it's a meeting we probably would normally wouldn't go to. And then I start talking to him. He said, Bobby, he said, I just wanted to go to a different meeting tonight. And I was flipping through the meeting directory, and this meeting just jumped out at me. That's why I came here. We have 1,600 meetings a week. Our meeting directory is like 80 pages thick. And he said, as I flipped through the meeting directory, this meeting just jumped out at me. I am a firm believer that my God put that guy in my path. And I could do two things. I could do what I did, or I could do what I always did. See, the nice thing about having 8 siblings in a 10-year span, there's a close resemblance. And people will come up to me and say, hey, you SOB, I remember. You'll say, oh, no, not me. You're talking about my brother's Brian or my brother Sean. Yeah, and I had to make amends to them. You know, I know you're a cool. I don't know which one. And I ducked out of it all the time. You know? Or I could do what I did. I made the amends. It was a credible experience. Now, another experience on the ninth step, I'm at my, and for case anyone's watching, I actually started at 45, so I'm at 55 minutes now. I know, I see he's looking. No big deal. So I'm at this, my home group for a while was a stepping stone group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm at a business meeting. I make a motion. It was definitely for the betterment of AA. I know, because I made it. It had to be. Discussion follows, and like it's something that I've never seen happen before. The motion doesn't get seconded. Now, that's crazy, because we second everything in AA. For no other reason, we don't want to make the person feel bad. All right. That must be the Al-Anon in us. All right, I'll second this motion, you know. But my made matters worse, my boy Freddie's in the room. Now, I grew up in a neighborhood, right, wrong, or indifferent. We just had rules. Everyone knew what the rules were. They may be a little warped, you may think, but, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, you always backed your boy. Even if he's wrong, even if he got you beat up in a fight, you still had his back. You could always discuss that with him later. You never dated anybody else's ex. You know, I think you're cute, but, you know, you went out with Frankie in the 10th grade, so I can't talk to you. I mean, it's just like that. It's just rules. You know, so, but I can't, and I'm even looking at Freddie. I'm giving him the eye, like, yo, get it, you know. And he's looking at me, and he wouldn't put his hand. I couldn't believe it. My motion goes down in flames. I said, the hell, I would never talk to him again. I would come to the meeting, there'd be 6-7 men. I'd say hi to 3 or 4 of them. I completely ignore Freddie. I said, the hell with them. I'm at work one day. My coworker came up to me. He was sober, and he came up to me. He said, Bobby, Freddie Wheels is outside. He wants to take care of some sort of business. I peeked out the window. I saw him sitting in his car. I said, you know what? I said, tell him to take his fat ass down to City Hall. He can't do that here. A few weeks later, that same coworker called me up. He said, Bobby, he said, Freddie Wheels died last night. And he said, the reason I'm calling you is because he always spoke so highly of you. Now, here he was a friend of mine. And as God is my judge, I cannot tell you what that motion was about. That's how petty it was. He was put in my path many, many times. And I didn't make amends because, you know what, I always assumed he'd be there. And I guess once I get off my high horse, I would have made amends to him. And the moment that my coworker said, Bobby, because he always spoke so highly of you, I felt about yay big. And I've been praying for Freddie ever since. So that's two experiences on the ninth step. See, that key word is wherever possible. I also thought that said whenever possible. Whenever's time, wherever's place. And for me, it's never the right time. You know why? Because I'm too busy easy doesn't it. Keeping it simple. You know, the 10th step for me is nothing but 4 through 9 on a regular basis. Now, if I stand up here and tell you I do a 10th step every day, that's not true. I'm pretty good with it, though. You know, sometimes 5, 6, 7 times a week. Then there's other times I try to stay sober on yesterday's sobriety and, you know, I pay the price. And I always used to say, if I don't do a 10th step on a regular basis, no one knows but me. That's also not true. Because when I'm not practicing these principles, I operate in nitwit mode. And should you cross my path in nitwit mode, you too are affected, you know? The 11th step, I'll tell you a funny story. A few years ago, I was driving out the street and some guy beeped at me. And I know sometimes when I drive, it's like I got Tourette syndrome, you know? And I get fed and I'm fucking, you know, and I do that stuff. And this guy beeped at me, right? And I just lost it. And a few weeks later, I'm at this large scale AA event in Philadelphia. And this guy, Carl, comes up, and he's like one of my favorite guys. Sober a long time, very serene. I've never heard him say a bad word. Just a really good guy. He came up to me, he said, Bobby, I saw you over 3rd and Poplar a couple weeks ago. He said, I beeped and waved at you. And he said, you waved back. And he said it with a twinkle in his eye, and I was so embarrassed. I said, of all people. Of all, I got caught. But you know what? I never got away with nothing. I thought I did. I got caught every single time. And you know what? If I didn't get caught, you know what? I got caught. You know, I always paid the price. I didn't get away. I couldn't believe it. I said, of all people, Carl, great. How come I couldn't flip off somebody else? You know? The 11th step through me, the prayer and meditation, and to improve my conscious contact. I got a conscious contact with my higher power. Now, I may not pray and meditate as the way I was indoctrinated as a kid, but I pray and meditate on a daily basis. And I guess I don't want to tell you the way I do it, because to be honest, I don't want to offend anybody. And up to this point, I've been giving you my experience. I'm about to give you my opinion. I very rarely give it from the podium. I think that's what the hospitality room is for. But I'm going to give you my opinion very quickly. Whenever I do, I always qualify it to it. So this is my opinion. I think this is why Alcoholics Anonymous is so successful, because it gave me the freedom to find a way to which I would be comfortable in prayer and meditation. Even though our book gives us a lot of different suggestions and real good direction, I'm glad it gives me those choices, because if there were a particular way to pray and meditate, because of my misdirected resentment towards God and organized religion, I would not be here today. So that's just my opinion. And the truth was, you know what? As I go through the steps, the church wasn't the problem. God wasn't the problem. The Air Force wasn't the problem. The police department wasn't the problem. My mom wasn't a problem. My mom was just a sick woman. The problem was me, Bobby Coyle. I was definitely the problem before I picked up a drink. And I guarantee I was the problem, obviously, when I was drinking. But you know what? When I put the drink down, I was still the problem. The steps was incredible. Not only did it remove the obsession to drink, there's a lot of things about my past that I'm not proud of. And I'm even talking sober. I'm not up here to do a fifth step. It's as a general way. And if I could change them in a heartbeat, I could. I would, but I can't. But what the steps enable me to do, it changes my attitude about the past, which enables me to use it as a tool to help other people. You know, it was just incredible. You know, the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I've had a spiritual awakening. Now, I haven't seen any burning bushes. I haven't seen any lightning bolts. I haven't heard voices from above, except there. Oh, yeah. We couldn't have timed that any better. Yeah. So I had to correct that, because I said it's been a while since I heard any voices at all. But you know, and I'm truly grateful for that. But you know what? I've had that change of attitude. That's what I had. We tried to carry this message. That's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to thousands of meetings. I hear some crazy things. I got to scratch my head and look up at the slogans and make sure I'm in an AA meeting. That's the message. But I have to remember the word try. Because when I first went through the steps of the big book, you know, I went through my evangelical stage. I had my fireman's hat on, and I went to save everybody, and I would quote it, and this is the only way to do it. If you're not doing it this way, you're wrong. And I would close the book, and I'd backhand you with it to make sure that the message sunk in. I mean, I was nuts. I had an old-timer come up to me one time, and he came up. He said, you know what, kid? He said, you got a real nice message. He's, but you offend people the way you come off. And I'm glad he did not say this cross-talk in a meeting. He pulled me off to the side, and I really admired this man. And he said it with love, but he was giving me some direction. And I'm glad that he did, because if he said it in a public forum or any other way, I would have probably told him to, you know, do a couple of things. But I know he meant well. And I've learned that over the years. I'm a little bit more love and tolerance of others is their code. But I don't compromise the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't do that because I would do you a disservice. I really believe in the directions that are laid out, but I can be a little bit more tactful in my delivery. Remember, it's not what I say, it's the way I say it. But the most important part of that 12th step is to practice these principles in all my affairs. I'm only in an AA meeting an hour and a half a day. What about the other 22 and a half hours? What about the time on the job or the time in my neighborhood where it's tough to do the right thing, you know? I mean, I can stand up here and sound good and quote the literature and do all this other stuff, but I leave here, you know, and if I go crazy in the airport or, you know, and act out, then that's not practicing these principles in all my affairs. The 12th step takes many different forms and fashion. Like the committee, you guys will put this on today, that's 12th step work, you know? There's many other things to do. You know, some of us who may have time may get involved in general service and get involved in the central office, you know. There's various 12-step committees, you know. There's corrections. I know corrections aren't for everyone. I'll tell you a story. A number of years ago, my sponsor called me up. He said, Bobby, we're going up to Holmesburg on Monday night. He gave me like a week's notice. I said, no, we're not. He said, well, yes, you are. I said, I'm not. And so Monday night, I go pick him up. We go up to Holmesburg. But I realized the day before that the Eagles are playing the Cowboys on Monday Night Football. So I'm going to give him a call up, and I say, you know, try to make up some sort of deal, a story there. And he said, Bobby, you gave me your word. He said, that's a commitment. I'll see you. And he hung up. So I picked him up. We had dinner. We go up to jail. You know, because to be honest, I didn't want to go there. I didn't think I had anything in common with these guys. You know, I thought I would have to embellish my story. I would have to use some profanity. Like, I had nothing in common with these guys at all. And my sponsor said, Bobby, it doesn't matter what you do for a living, and you don't need to tell the guys that, you know. It's a message of hope. So I go up there, and, you know, the whole thing, you get buzzed in, surrender your belongings, valuables, and things like that. We get buzzed in, we're sitting there, and no one shows up. They're all on the block watching the game. Because before my sponsor told me, that when he said, you gave me your word, there's a commitment. And then he said, besides, if you pick up a drink, I don't think Randall Cunningham's going to 12-step your ass. And that's when he hung up on me. So I get mad. No one shows up. So when I leave, I remember I made some sort of flip remark to the CEO. I said, I guess you transferred all your alcoholics to Greaterford, which is like the state penitentiary further up. And so he didn't know what the hell I was talking about. So I'm driving home, and my sponsor, like I'm trying to, I get in the game on the radio, right? But now he wants to talk to him. So, oh, Christ, would you shut up? And then he picks up on it. He says, you don't get it, you selfish SOB. We were here just in case they showed up. We are responsible for the effort, not the outcome. And I know corrections aren't for everyone. You know, there's other 12-step opportunities. There's treatment facilities. There's PI, public information. There's CPC. That's not PCP, that's CPC. Cooperation with professional community. You take a student to an open AA meeting. You know, most professional schools require attendance at meetings, whether they be nursing or medical schools, divinity students, social workers. So for one day when they're in their chosen profession, should they come across a patient, a client, a parishioner, they'll know how to direct them. It's great work, you know. So there's a lot of different 12-step opportunities, you know. Our preamble says, our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. If I'm only staying sober, not helping the other alcoholic, that's half measures, and half measures of does nothing. We have a statement, I am responsible. When anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there. And for that, I'm responsible. I can't worry about what other people are doing. People say, that service, that's about politics. I tell you, that has not been my experience. In fact, my experience, those who get involved in service are some of the most selfless people I've ever met. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of times during football season, I want to stay home and watch the Eagles, as painful as was this past season. You guys from Seattle had a nice run, though. Guys had a real nice run. But, you know, and there's times I want to watch a game, but you know what? There may be an assembly or something that I go to because, to be honest, I enjoy it. At first, I felt obligated, but you know, I kind of enjoy going to that. And my experience, like I said, these are the most selfless people I ever met. And not only that, but my experience, these people who, there's a big difference between being around AA and being in AA. And these people of service, man, they're staying sober, you know? So, now, I know everyone doesn't have the time to do that, you know? I am a firm believer that everyone in this room has a gift. It may be different than the person sitting next to you, but it's your gift. You need to find out what it is. You know, and that's great stuff. And then it's when I learned about the traditions. And I love the traditions. The traditions are to the group, but the steps are to the individuals. The steps are how it works, and the traditions are why it works, you know? Great stuff. I was in Mexico 15 years ago. I thought I could speak Spanish. All those years in the barrio, my Spanish consisted of like, dame pistola, which is give me your gun, you know? So I'm there speaking Spanish, and those poor people probably still figuring out what the hell I was saying. So I switched over to English, and I was the only English-speaking person in the room. And you know what? At the end of the meeting, they came up and they hugged me. And I can tell who the old-timer was by the surrender in their face, and I can tell who the new guy was by the pain in their face. They may not have understood, but you know what? They understood. Language of the heart, you know? My dad called me a few years ago, and, you know, like making amends to my dad was, it was hard. But when I told him, you know, I guess I was sober about 4 years, and you know, he hugged me. He said, Bobby, he said, it's okay. He said, your mom was sick. And there were other attempts at her life before. So, but that was incredible, you know. I got to send him back to Ireland a while ago. And it was, and you know, guys, we're just not real good showing emotion. It's an Irish characteristic, you know. But he came home and he hugged me and he said, you know what, man, it's the best gift I ever got. It was pretty neat. Somebody called me a few years ago. He said, Bobby, he said, Joe, across the street. He said, Joe wants your phone number. Is it okay? I said, yeah, Dad, give it to him. That's why my name's in the phone book. I dropped the Benedict. I know it's back in vogue, but I dropped it. But you look, Robert Ignatius Coyle, 707 Sears Street, if you're ever near me, it's in the phone book. I'm not hiding today. I said, sure, Dad, give him my phone number. So Joe called me up. Joe, he lived right across the street from us. He owned the bar on the corner. And in fact, at the end of my corner, you know, there's four corners in the intersection. There were three bars, tap rooms. And Joe had the toilet of a bar. And if he ever asked, he said, where's the toilet? I said, it's right here. You're standing in the damn thing. So, but towards the end of my drinking, Joe did not allow, he flagged me from his bar. In fact, he used some colorful language. He said, Bobby, I know you. I seen you grow up. I know what you did for a living. I know your family. I don't care. You're not allowed in my bar. And if you come in my bar, he used some colorful language to let me know what he was going to do. I said, all right, Joe, no big deal. So I just walked across the street and drank there. So a few years later, a few years ago, my dad called me up. And so I said, give him Joe my number. Joe gave me a call. He said, Bobby, you still do them AA meetings? I said, yeah, Joe, I do, you know. And the truth is, in my neighborhood, bad news travels quickly. No one wants to tell the good news, like, you know, like Joey graduated with honors or Salvi got married. No one wants to talk. We want to talk about, like, Anthony, violated his parole or Frankie did this, you know. So, but he would have known if I wasn't drinking, if I wasn't going to AA, if I was drinking again. He said, I was wondering if you could help me. He said, my nephew Jimmy just getting out of treatment. He's 17 years old. And I guess it was closer to 8 years ago, because he's 25 now. And he said, I was wondering if you could take him to meetings. See, Joe had five kids of his own, small family. However, his brother and sister-in-law were killed in an automobile accident coming back from the Jersey Shore. And they had six kids of their own. And Joe took his nephews and nieces in and raised them. And, I mean, you talk about a man. I mean, he's just a good guy. And he raised these kids as his own. So, but he called me up. He said, I was wondering if you'd take my nephew Jimmy to an AA meeting. Now, here was a guy that years ago threatened me with bodily harm if I came anywhere near his toilet or the bar that he owned. And now he wants to take his nephew to an AA meeting, you know. Now, Joe didn't know nothing about AA. He owned a bar, you know, didn't know nothing about AA. But he knew that I was a nitwit and that I had changed my life. And he didn't know how the hell it worked, but he said, Christ, if it worked for him. Jimmy's 25 years old, married, got a kid. He's sober almost 8 years, in grad school, working on his MSW. I mean, but you know what? It's nothing I did, because I told Jimmy the same thing I told countless other guys. And if I'm want to take the credit for his success, then I need to accept responsibility for those who failed. And unfortunately, my experience, my successes are far outnumbered by the failures, you know. You know, I hit them right between the eyes. I tell them what the deal is, and it's really up to you whether you want to follow the directions, you know. 1993, I finished up very quickly. I got elected. I was the alternate area delegate, Area 59. I was going to be the youngest delegate ever to the General Service Conference. Who that delegate was and how old they were, I have no idea, but it was going to be me. And I was going places, you know. And I was also training to run the Boston Marathon. In fact, that's coming up next week. And I was a runner. You got a runner there? Good. Good luck. I wanted to do the Boston Marathon, but to do Boston, you need to qualify. I mean, they have a lottery, but you usually have to qualify. So the Marine Corps and the New York City Marathon is usually the same day. So I'm training for the Marine Corps Marathon. And I took a tumble one day, and I just had this shoulder pain, and I kind of shrugged it off, and some other things were bothering me. I said, you know what, I said, let me go get checked out. I want to make sure I'm in good shape for this. And I went to the hospital. A few days later, they called me up, and I got diagnosed with lung cancer. I never smoked in my life. I mean, a little reefer for a short period of time, but that don't count. But I mean, you know, I didn't work around. I had none of the indicators. I mean, it doesn't run in my family, nothing like that. So I went to go get a second opinion, obviously, and I actually went to get a third, and it got confirmed. I said, damn, you know? And I don't want to think, yeah, I handled this well, because I didn't, because I was full of self-pity. I mean, I'm doing the right thing. I'm angry, you know? I tell you, when I first got diagnosed, I actually got sick. It floored me. So I went to get confirmed, and it got confirmed, so I start doing my treatment. And my sponsor at the time, Bobby, he said, Bobby, what are you going to do about this? And ironically, 2 years later, he would die of lung cancer. So I went through the treatment, and I bounced back, and then I got really sick. You know, and I'd been battling this off and on, but then I really got sick, where they actually had to remove the lower left lobe of my lung, you know? And after I got out of the hospital, I was in the hospital for a while, and after I got out of the hospital, I was laid up in my house. And I couldn't make meetings. I always made meetings. With 1,600 meetings, there's no excuse not to make a meeting, you know? We got them around the clock. But I couldn't make meetings. And people start coming to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm just not talking about my friends. I'm talking about someone who I may have met once or twice at the assembly, or someone I didn't even know again who was tagging along with somebody else. They came to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're looking at a liar, thief, and a cheat. I took from everyone. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery. And people came to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm a firm believer that my doctors did a pretty good job, but you know what, I'm definitely a firm believer in prayer, and prayer definitely helped, you know. And, you know, I bounced back, and I, you know, battling back and forth, but it's been a couple years that, you know, I had a thing done almost 2 years ago. I'm doing good now, you know, I kind of glow in the dark, but other than that, I'm doing all right. But the truth is, you know what, even though I may have had an excuse to go out and get loaded, I didn't have a reason to go out and get loaded. You know, I had a pretty good life. Because I made thousands of meetings, I've seen some men and women, and again, I heard it earlier today when the speaker said that I've made thousands of meetings, and I've seen some men and women go through some terrible things of their own, and they did not pick up a drink, you know, life on life terms, you know, and it's just a wonderful way of life, you know. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I said real quickly, I mentioned a couple times, I said that I'm a mummer. I usually save this towards the end because I know some of you are confused, but there are a few people from Jersey I came across. Witness Protection Program, high and up here. The Marshals will be here tomorrow to move you again, but you know. The mummers, I'm a third generation mummer. The mummers is a parade we do in Philadelphia on New Year's Day. It's been around for hundreds of years, and in fact, but it got so nuts, in 1901, the city had to organize the mayhem, and that's what they did. So 1901 is the first official parade. It's what it is. It's like a joint combination of the Full Monty and the Mardi Gras. It's like men with sequins, feathers, and makeup, and we play instruments, and we spoof everyone. We are not politically correct, so please... shame on you if you're sensitive. It's a blast. It's a drunk fest. It's the longest continuous parade in the country. It goes about 12, 13 hours. There's 30,000 of us. It's just nuts. And it's New Year's Day in Philadelphia. It's bitter cold, and it's just a hoot. It really is a blast. Mummers is actually derived from Mummus, who is the Greek god of ridicule. So that's, you know, antiquity. We're a little class there, right? So, but it's just nuts. And it's great. I'm a lifelong mummer, third generation mummer, matter of fact, you know. And so I'm at a midnight meeting, and I tell you about midnight meetings. Midnight meetings are either the most spiritual or the most bizarre. No little middle ground. I mean, you'll have guys with capes and ray guns and people working second shift. Midnight meetings are great. So I'm at a midnight meeting 16 years ago, and I'm telling my story. A guy come up to me afterwards and said, listen, would you be interested in watching the mummers parade? I said, you're out of your mind, people, places, and things. He said, you don't understand. We're starting a group called the 12 Steppers, Sober Mummers. Sober Mummers, that's like an oxymoron. So what I did, I got involved in the parade, and this past year, I'm the only original one left. This past year was my 15th year up the street with the 12 Steppers New Year's Brigade. It also happened to be my 37th parade. And a couple years ago, I got selected as captain of the brigade. That's a very high honor. So back in the day, you would have been the head drunk, but here it is. My point is, if you can do sobriety, strut up Broad Street on New Year's Day in Philadelphia, anything is possible. One of my favorite sayings in the big book says, we absolutely insist on a joy in life. If the newcomer could see no joy in our existence, they won't want nothing to do with us. Now, obviously, I just paraphrased that last sentence. I'll never be as eloquent as Bill, but you get the idea. So whatever you did drunk, you could be stone cold sober and do it. You could be better at it, you could have more fun, and most importantly, you remember it. It's a blast, you know? So if you are new and you think that you have to wear the hair shirt and your life is over because you're an Alcoholics Anonymous man, you're greatly mistaken. Your life is just starting. Get a home group, get a sponsor. I always say these controversial remarks for the end because I'll be getting off in about 5 minutes. Get a sponsor. If your sponsor hasn't done the steps, they really have no business sponsoring you. How do you find out your sponsor's done the steps? How do you find out? You ask them, excuse me, have you done the steps? You're either going to hear two things, yes or no. You hear yes, that's your person. You know, get a home group, start praying. It's a combination. It's just not one thing. I hear people say, I did the steps, I still get drunk. That's a lie. Nowhere in the steps does it say go out and buy a fifth. You know, it doesn't, you know. In fact, we actually have a guarantee in the book. It says, you know, when all else fails, working with another alcoholic will prevent us from picking up that drink, you know. So get a home group, get a sponsor, get involved in service, stick your hand out. It's a wonderful way of life, you know. I close with this, what's going on today. You know, I got a wonderful life. That kid on the bike, what happened to that kid? You know the old saying, God looks out after drunks, fools, and kids? Well, he was working.